Hello, this is Pam Bloom with broadcast number one of the book 90 Years with Dogs by Dorothy M. Norris. Dog characters and personalities are as varied as those of their owners. Over many years, the author has experienced loyalty, affection, and understanding from different dog breeds as she worked to support herself and her family. As 90 Years with Dogs reveals, life has not been easy, but dogs have brought much constant support and companionship. Based on living with dogs in England and Canada, 90 Years with Dogs is a journey of discovery, appreciation, and exploration of the close bonds that can develop between humans and animals. Dorothy Norris hopes that her readers will enjoy some armchair travel, biographical writing with a special place for dogs, and take the opportunity to revisit memories and long-forgotten details of times spent with their own much-loved companions. Such memories live on, enriching lives as they bring strength and pleasure. Dorothy M. Norris is a retired teacher, freelance writer and collector with children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren who share her love of dogs. This book was published in 2023 by YPS Publishing in UK. This book is in memory of my canine companions and is dedicated to my three children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren, and the dogs who have become such important members of each family through the decades. Preface. When looking back over many decades, there are different ways of remembering. Lots simply is forgotten or so buried under other details that it rarely resurfaces, if at all, unless triggered by something unexpectedly. Some memories even seem better avoided and consigned to the past, while others are shared and reshared over time, too. Retelling gives them a shape and form that includes some details and omits others. Following one strand of remembering, the journey of life has its own appeal, too, a way to relive and reflect that provides a focus and continuity through what, as the following pages reveal, has been a series of ups and down episodes in different places and times. The idea of writing something about my life with dogs has been around for a while. Dogs have been such constant companions over the years and brought such comfort, pleasure, and at times a profound sense of security. My dependence on dogs as friends, confidants, and listeners is undeniable. They and their need for care have helped to steer me through difficult times and to give purpose to the day ahead. What better than to turn to my doggy memories when the COVID pandemic struck in 2020? Lockdown came 8 weeks after my dog Leo died. I had already decided that I would not own another. I had to face the daily unfolding of an international horror story without a canine friend. Lockdown imposed an unprecedented level of isolation, even by my own standards of living alone in remote places. Unable to hug, to talk to people other than through windows, to go anywhere, I was connected to the outside world only via the phone, Skype, and doorstep deliveries of groceries. Even letters through the post seemed to stop. The daily announcements from government ministers and medical experts brought the crisis into our homes relentlessly. Weeks turned into months. Masks, distorted voices, and even worse for someone with poor eyesight, obscured faces. When socially distanced doorstep visits became possible, the inability to see or touch perpetuated lockdown ordeal. I dealt with the pandemic by taking my thoughts somewhere else. I found comfort as I wrote down my memories of living with dogs. Other details crept in, too, although it was never intended to be an autobiography. It is a celebration of canine companionship. I hope that others may find pleasure and enjoyment in their own dogs as I have done for so many years. Dorothy M. Norris, West Yorkshire, January 2023. Chapter 1, The Importance of Dogs. There have always been dogs in my life. Toby was the first, my father's dog, born a few years before I arrived on the scene in Victoria, British Columbia in Western Canada, June 1929. I do not remember Toby, but I am sure he sniffed at the new arrival, guarded the pram from dangers only he perceived, and later tolerated the small hands that grabbed his shaggy back. My mother, sister, and I returned to Great Britain, as it was then known, within a couple of years. I was still small and golden from the Pacific sun and island air, a color soon to disappear in our new home on the moorlands of Staffordshire. From an urban home in the expanding colonial settlement of Victoria, we had to adjust to the often bleak hilltop home we now shared with three generations of our English family. It was bewildering. We overlooked the Trent Valley from our craggy perch, with the pottery's great bottle ovens, coal mines, and steelworks in the distance. I could not see them with my myopic vision, but this would not be detected for some years. There was a steep green slope below our small walled garden, and it was not long before I lost my much-loved wooden hoop among the rocky outcrops, crying bitterly as I had few toys. The nearest buildings were a farm and outbuildings where I spent many daylight hours. Those were the days when children could safely roam, or at least adults voiced fewer concerns. A farm was an ideal playground with straw, mud, chickens and ducks, half-empty stone barns and cowsheds still warm and pleasantly smelly from their overnight residence. Occasionally, there was a blur of a scurrying rat, but I loved the rustle of mice wherever there was hay. Occasionally, I saw the farmer's wife doing some late milking into a pail, electricity having not yet reached the outbuildings or, for that matter, the farmhouse. I loved to watch the great cart horse being led across the yard with its harness jingling and catching the early morning sun, but the most important reason to be there was to see my friend. She was a rough-haired collie called Molly, although the farmer called her Moll. She had a long-haired coat of black, brown, and sandy colors. She often roamed freely, but she also spent long hours tethered and lying in her kennel at the entrance to the cobblestone yard. With just her head visible, she watched the comings and goings around the farm, her eyes and ears alert. When I approached, she would often rise to greet me, her lovely brush of a tail waving lazily to and fro before lying down again in the same place. I do not recall when I first joined her in her spacious shelter. Possibly a sudden gust of wind or rain made me take cover, but she cannot have objected. I was small enough to fit into the dark interior behind her amidst the sacks and rags that were her bed, and it was warm and comforting. I once hid there after getting into trouble at home and caused a frantic search when I failed to return. It was a farm worker who finally suggested where I might be. We were friends for years, even after my family moved to a more spacious home about a mile away. I visited Molly as often as I could, for I missed the wildness and disorder of our rocky hilltop and the comfort of her presence. The thought never entered my mind that she was getting older until the sad day when I found Molly was no longer there. Her memory is still dear to me. The storm clouds of war were gathering over Europe when we at last had a dog of our own. Lady was actually my aunt's dog. Aunt Billy, a nickname from the First World War when she had kept goats to supplement the family's food. She was my mother's sister. She was a teacher, and our new property had been designed to accommodate not only the family home, but a separate school building where she and her mother, also a teacher, would continue to operate a private school. There was also space for stables and outhouses for the goats and other animals she would soon acquire. As the family had always owned a dog in the past, I imagine a dog was part of the plan, together with poultry, ducks, Belgian hares, and much later, a calf and pig raised and renewed annually. The dog was almost the last to arrive. My aunt called her Lady. Lady was not very old and had a sad history, as her mother had been found with her puppies out on the moors, terrified and half starving. She was a Welsh border collie, black and white, with the usual plume of a tail, and the puppies were obviously purebred. How they came to the area was a mystery, locally speculated upon, but never resolved. I had badly wanted a dog of my own and was disappointed when my mother pointed out that she belonged to my aunt and would not live with us, but in the schoolhouse next door. My aunt, ever the diplomat in our extended family, solved the problem and said that I could own Lady's tail, which was nonsense, but it meant a lot to me at the time. Lady actually lived in one of the stables but was later housed in the corner of the school's combined kitchen and cloakroom. That became her sanctuary, even after the room had been reinforced with sandbags at the outbreak of the Second World War and became the warden's post, a key part of self-defense, and advising local people about what to do in case of attack. Lady was always a nervous dog, but seemed to accept the regular invasion of her space by my uncle and other local men together with the addition of a stretcher hung on the school's cloakroom pegs and a stirrup pump and protective clothing in case of a mustard gas attack. There were other items, too, but Lady probably took their presence for granted, as the children did as they walked or ran through the room numerous times a day. Provided no one disturbed her in the corner, Lady was content. My aunt said she was highly strung, which did not mean much to me then, conjuring up visions of the strings on my grandmother's mandolin twanging as they broke. Poor Lady had certainly suffered traumas out on the moors, but she matured into a quiet, reliable companion. She was very anxious during thunderstorms, tending to panic if I left alone, and soon discovered that she disliked us singing. We were not very kind, as we thought it was funny when she howled in unison, not understanding that it must have hurt her ears. I only realized this some years later when she showed no reaction to the deeper notes of an organ. Lady had very acute hearing, picking up and noticeably stiffening at the faraway sounds of air raid warnings long before the nearest one in the valley started wailing. The distant sounds of anti-aircraft guns in the evening was a signal for someone to shout, "Where's Lady?" And while she was being located, I would slip out into the darkness of the garden to watch the distant searchlights sweeping the sky, ever hopeful of seeing an aircraft caught in the twin beams. As a family, we had watched sheepdog trials when on holiday in Wales, but my aunt never considered Lady as a working dog. Auntie Billy rented land at the end of our lane and took our three nanny goats and any half-grown kids there every morning to graze. Each had a collar, and they were tethered on long chains to enjoy a fresh patch of grass each day. Lady, my aunt's outdoor shadow, accompanied them, stopping now and again when she found something interesting, ignored by and accepting the animals she saw daily. One day, for reasons unknown, the leading goat decided to suddenly run on ahead. It shocked my aunt, but she was surprised when Lady rushed after it, caught its collar, and effectively stopped the other goats who were following. From then on, Lady stayed with the small herd as they walked to and from their pasture, watching them intently. Goats are intelligent creatures, and as far as I know, none of them ran off again. Throughout the war years, I had long periods of illness, followed by weeks of convalescence. My grandmother had passed away sometime previously, so my mother and aunt were now both teaching in the school next door. Their brother was also out all day. He taught at a school in a small mining community some miles away, so I spent many hours alone. I had pet mice and rabbits, and there were always cats in and out of the house, but Lady was never allowed inside. I desperately wanted a dog of my own, but my mother was not an animal-y sort of person. She hated the presence of the goats and the hens clucking around her when she hung out the washing. She saw nothing funny when she was followed into the kitchen one day by a file of ducks. When my mother started teaching, we had a lady in the to cook the school dinners. She owned a pedigree spaniel, and a neighbor had a pedigree setter, both of lovely red-bronze color. By some accident, there had been a litter of pedigree mistakes, and with the connivance of my uncle and aunt, she determined to give me one of the puppies, a little black bitch, to keep me company. My mother's objections were overruled, as they usually were. She was the youngest of the three siblings, and really, I think she found the puppy irresistible, although she would not have admitted it. I called the puppy RAF, the Royal Air Force being my favorite in the armed services. And I'm sure the dog's presence helped me to get well both then and later during other prolonged absences from school in my early teens. I had no knowledge then of that the keeping of pets during the early years of the war was actively discouraged. But maybe the advice of the National Air Raid Precautions Animals Committee had not reached the Staffordshire Moors. When this came to my attention recently, I thought of our only local signpost, which should have been removed in case of invasion. Someone had indeed tried, but having loosened, it had found that the ornate knob above the three arms had rusted firmly into position. The village children found it made an excellent swing when walking past, and it daily pointed a different way. I think it remained in place for some considerable time. I cannot recall my earliest walks with Raff, probably due to my ill health. She stayed with me in the house and later the garden before I was able to go out. The family were great walkers, and as the village had only an hourly bus service to the nearest town, we were accustomed to walking long distances in all directions. I had a detailed knowledge of the local countryside. The entire family had always gone out together to gather the seasonal fruits, blackberries, bilberries, elder and rowan berries and rose hips, and my mother and aunt made jellies, jams, and pickles. It was one of my aunt's many hobbies and was a real asset during later food shortages. The school had extra rations, but I remember only enormous tins of orange jelly, which must have arrived from overseas on one of the Merchant Navy shipping convoys, a perilous voyage, but we children did not think of such things. I knew the pathways and bridle tracks, shortcuts and canal towpaths for miles around, and was later able to do my own exploring with Raff on a lead and Lady walking beside me. The dogs had bonded from the start. Lady had never had puppies of her own, and possibly Raff saw her as a mother figure when she first arrived. They had very different personalities, Lady quietly mature, while Raff had boundless energy and a frisky joy of life, but I do not think they ever had a difference of opinion. Each had their own well-defined space, and they made perfect companions. When the day promised fine weather, our school cook would prepare a picnic lunch for me so I could spend longer out in the fresh air, times that have left such happy memories. All animal feed was rationed, which may have had something to do with the demise of our free-ranging chickens and ducks. I am sure they ended up in an oven, a timely and useful end, as Raff gradually developed the skill of a poultry thief. I recall our village Bobby, police constable, who was the friend of most people for miles around, bringing Raff back one dark night, his belt being used as a lead, with a dead chicken in his other hand. There was a feather still dangling from Raff's nose. "You better put this in the pot tonight," he told whoever answered the door. "Keep that little bitch in if you can." Raff always looked so innocent, but one had to learn fast where canine crimes are concerned. Raff had grown into a beautiful dog, larger than her mother and with many of the characteristics of her father. Sometimes the sun catching her glossy black hair showed a reddish tint, but no one would have guessed the color of her parents. Her tail had not been docked and streamed out gracefully behind her. Unlike Lady, who was completely trustworthy, Raff's freedom had to be restricted unless we were all the way from the village. Fortunately, our garden abutted fields and moorland, and our nearest farmer knew her well. She and I were frequent visitors there, and she was not interested in either cows or the large cart horses, although I am sure any poultry we met fled cackling to safety. Both Lady and Raff were very friendly dogs and greatly appreciated by the children who came to our school. They called Lady the goat dog, but over the years, Raff became known as the school dog, some of the older children taking her out for walks during their playtime. The dog's friendly approach to all and sundry, however, got me into profound trouble on one occasion. Walking across the fields bordering our local golf course, the dogs exploring a little ahead, they came across a German POW brewing tea on a Primus stove in a ditch close to where a busload of his fellows were working. By the time I caught up, man and dogs were getting along famously. I was greeted with an effusive gush of broken English, and he stroked my hair. I was blonde and had long plaits, so I expect I reminded him of home. The dogs and I did not linger, as a planned walk lay ahead. It seemed an exciting rather than troubling encounter at the time, and something to recount when I got home, but soon forgotten. Returning much later in the day by road, I saw the men climbing into the transport back to camp, and thinking of my earlier encounter, I waved goodbye. There were strict rules about fraternizing with the enemy. Not that it meant much to me at that stage in the war, but some villager reported my innocent action to the family. As a result, I received the only scolding I ever had from my uncle. The fact that I had upset him far more important to me than his anger, which was hard for me to understand. One of my favorite walks was across the fields to the nearest village and our local church. Raph could run free, and even the last short stretch by road was safe, as apart from the hourly bus, there were only farm vehicles, and one could hear the horses' hooves from a quarter of a mile away. I loved the solitude and the peace of the little stone-built church where my grandfather had been curate, assistant vicar, many years before. In those days, churches were never locked, and if the door was locked to stop it blowing open in the wind, the key was always left on a ledge and easy to reach. The dogs would follow me in and up the aisle to where there was a pedal organ, and they would settle on the foot of the chancel steps while I sat down for an enjoyable hour at the instrument. Looking back, I'm sure Raph probably sniffed around a bit before relaxing, but they were both tired from their walk. I played by ear, never having been able to read music clearly due to my myopia. It was a mixture of hymns, folk songs, bits of Gilbert and Sullivan, and some of my uncle's sea shanties. He had been in the Royal Navy in the First World War. I imagined the grandfather I never met standing in the pulpit, listening to me with pleasure, which probably he would not have done, really, as he seems to have been a bit of a puritanical character. Every so often, I told the dogs I would not be long. They were used to it and slept on peacefully, knowing their routine and enjoying the cool, quiet building and the sunlight which sometimes streamed through the stained glass windows, warming the mat where they lay. The years rolled on and I left school. In 1946, when I went to college in London, my mother, as mothers do, accepted caring for Raph as her responsibility. This had probably happened long before, but children take a lot for granted, particularly when they have pets needing care through times of poor health. The school children helped out, and Raph accompanied them on many school excursions, loved by all. With so few privately owned cars, dogs often traveled long distances with their owners, both by bus or rail. Lady and Raph had always been part of our family excursions, either to the seaside or perhaps the nearest lakes, where rowing boats could be hired. Due to numbers, our family always hired two boats, and Lady went in one and Raph in the other. She loved water and went over the side frequently, hoping to catch a duck. She never succeeded and was slow to learn the reason for the irritation of the nearest family member when she was hauled back on board and shook herself. Once established in London, my life seemed far removed from the country idyll of my childhood memories. The city was trying to rise from the ashes of war, a slow process of clearing rubble, temporary repair and rebuilding. Following my college year, my uncle took me on a walking tour in France, two fascinating weeks where we not only experienced the aftermath of the chaos and destruction of the European conflict, the despair, food shortages, and poverty, but also encountered tales of courage and much friendliness from people we met. I felt the whole world was in transit, a new experience to the seeming stability of my teenage years. Looking back, it was a perfect preparation for the subsequent difficulty of years living in London, years of love and loss, becoming a mother, the first job, accommodation, friendships, despair, and happiness. I had little time to visit home, and later, with two small children to care for alone, my own mother had to visit me, accompanied by Raph. She had been to London several times before, traveling from the Midlands by steam train for many hours, but one visit nearly proved disastrous. While my mother waited for a taxi outside Euston Station, with her suitcase and the dog on her lead beside her, a vehicle accidentally hit Raph. Whether she was too close to the curb, we never discovered, but the first I knew about the accident was when my mother arrived at my garden flat in Hampstead, followed by the taxi driver carrying an apparently dying dog. They were both upset, and I remember he refused to accept the fare. Raph was laid on a hurriedly procured blanket in the corner of the kitchen, and we could only wait for the end. But Raph was a survivor. She loved life, too, much to give up, although it seemed she might have a fractured leg or pelvis. Raph remained immobile for my mother's entire stay, creating a lot of work as her appetite returned, and it was obvious that she could not be moved. Our landlord and landlady had accepted Raph's presence without any protest, although in 1950s London, it was still commonplace to see accommodation advertised with the words, "No Irish, no blacks, no dogs." prejudices took many ugly forms as a mother of two children of shared heritage. I knew only too well. I had been concerned that keeping Raff with me until she was better might jeopardize our tenancy, but I need not have worried. The couple were in their late 50s, perhaps early 60s, childless, and had seen much better days. They had gradually been forced to rent off each floor of their house, and our garden flat was the last to go. While they lived in a small section on the ground floor, we shared the stairs with them, and everyone in the building shared the hall and front door. They were a volatile couple, but we saw little of them unless they had a quarrel. They were sympathetic about Raff, and as none of the doors had locks, I am certain one of them checked on her needs when we were out. Raff loved companionship and attention, and I was so relieved when her tail began to show no sign of injury. At different points in a long convalescence, she managed to get up on her feet. Then she went out into our garden, and then she accompanied us along the road to the walks on Primrose Hill. It must have been the length of the school term when my mother again free to travel down to London again and take her home. After that, Raff was never able to scramble over walls, but what a welcome she received from the school children who would share her happy spirit and companionship for the remainder of her long life. Chapter 2, Dogs Large and Small. My aunt had bought a caravan, which was towed to a different part of the coast ready for the next summer holiday. There, different family members could indulge in their various interests, history, biology, zoology, geology, and archaeology. Of course, the dogs came too, so my children could enjoy their company while digging in the sand and exploring rock pools. I believe a second caravan must have been hired when everyone was present. I can recall with nostalgia the cramped interior of my aunt's van during a spell of bad weather and the smell of damp dogs, the sea, and drying clothes. Such times are long past, and there came a day when First Lady and then Raff were no longer present with us, and life moved on. Our lives in London, interesting but extremely challenging at times, always had a background desire of a return to the countryside, now a place just for holidays and escape. There was no room in our house for a dog, and there were few, if any, in our neighborhood. Our small garden flat in Primrose Hill was now just part of past memories. By the later 1950s, our home was a London house of three floors with a small garden. We had an au pair to look after my third child while I worked all day, and also a succession of cats. The latter were a necessity to keep the small and large London rodent population from taking over. I can still remember the rats at some of the underground stations running in and out of the tunnels while people waited for the next train. There were dogs in the outer suburbs, but in the West End, one was more likely to see a miniature poodle with a diamond collar and coat tinted to match their owner's hair, a lavender shade, being then popular. The type of dog I loved and yearned for often was completely absent. I cannot recall seeing even a guide dog in those days. Many events and changes would occur before once again bad health intervened in the course of my life, and we would again find ourselves back in the countryside. Illness, however debilitating, is a useful time to take stock, to plan a new course in life, and in my case, to shape a new career. My eldest children were in their final years at boarding school, the youngest attending the family's still surviving private school. On her 7th birthday, she was given a dog. Wilhelmina, soon to be shortened to Willie, was a little Welsh corgi. I imagine she came from the pet shop in the nearest town, where as a child I used to sell my surplus pet mice for 6 pence each. No one had heard of puppy farming in those days. Willie was a sturdy little dog, a plump puppy, but with the promise of a long body. She had the very short legs so characteristic of her breed and had short reddish-brown hair with a few white patches and a stubby tail, a complete contrast to past family dogs. Her love of life and the way her emotions were reflected in the waggle of her little tail won everybody's heart, and she was quick to learn what behaviors were not acceptable. As a puppy, she was very possessive of things she treasured. Someone had once given her a knuckle bone almost as big as herself. It was meant as a joke, as her little teeth could not have gripped any part of it, but she guarded this treasure in a fearsome way, and it took some subterfuge to eventually get rid of it. When she remembered, she searched for it again and again. Of course, Willie was not my dog, but the responsibility was mine, and as with all family pets, one becomes increasingly fond of them. Looking after their welfare as their owners grow and finally move on. In the mid-1960s, I bought a very old and abandoned building. It had been a public house and still had the license for alcoholic drinks attached to the freehold, which I dispensed with at the time of purchase. I was unaware that the building was in the process of being eaten away by woodworm, and I think the whole place was held together by the huge millstone grit blocks with which it had been constructed. In retrospect, it was a better choice than an old farm empty and for sale that I had discovered some months previously. The place was near my first English home, but there were legal problems, and the location would have been much too remote for daily travel. With hindsight, both options were completely eccentric, but at least the house we bought was more affordable with the help of a mortgage, not easy to arrange in those days as a single woman. Fully recovered from my last illness, I had found a temporary job and was anticipating being accepted as a mature student at the local teacher training college. The old pub, although remote, was fortunately on an hourly bus route and not too far from my new job and the college. We had a large enclosed cobbled yard at one side where horse-drawn wagons had once pulled in to offload the barrels of beer. It was an ideal place for Willie's favorite game. She had a large ball, and when it was kicked toward her, she was adept at stopping its progress and heading it back to the sender. Her energies were inexhaustible, and she would go on enjoying the activity until her playmate just gave up. She would then nose the ball around a few times before wandering off to find something else to do. We had discovered, while on holiday in the Brecon Beacons, another activity Willie enjoyed. It was an ideal area for flying kites, and when she saw our simple handmade one trembling on the ground prior to the initial run and launch, Willie began to get excited, barking nonstop, then chasing excitedly after the runner until the wind carried the kite skyward. Her barking became almost hysterical as it soared upward until she could do no more than stand quivering with eagerness, waiting for whatever would happen next. Her reaction was always the same, and I hoped she would experience this doggy thrill when we returned home. The kite did not have a long life, and no one made another due to a mixture of other interests and the position of her house. This part of the Staffordshire-Cheshire border was at an altitude of 1,000 feet, where we enjoyed some days with no wind at all, and sometimes gales so fierce that it was hard to stand upright away from the shelter of the nearest wall, not ideal conditions for flying kites. We had 12 bantams and their fierce husband, a feisty cockerel who strutted around the yard and the large outhouse where they all roosted. A series of vaulted cellars led off this building, but Willie never ventured into this area, intimidated by the ferocious bird, although when he was no longer around, she still kept out of the building and away from the more gentle hens. We found them delightful. Occasionally, they would fly onto one's arm when they were fed, and they provided us with many small eggs. Willie kept to the perimeter wall, yapping excitedly if anyone walked past, even though she could not see them, wagged her little tail with satisfaction after they had gone past, pleased that she was guarding her territory so well. Willie seemed to be attracted to large dogs, and some found her of great interest, too. We learned this inadvertently and partly because I was too busy to notice the signs. The yard wall was at least 2 meters high, and the entrance gates equally solid and impregnable. But at certain times, dogs can surmount the seemingly impossible. One lusty Heinz variety managed to gain access, possibly because a farm vehicle had been parked in the lane close to the wall, offering a step up, and he just came over the top. We had to force the heavy gates open amidst the weeds to get him out again. But that dog became the father of Willie's first litter of puppies, not welcomed by me, but soon loved and sadly missed when we found new homes for them. It was always a difficult but necessary task to part with young animals. Unfortunately, Willie seemed to find an even larger dog next time, and for a few years I had to deal with the same pattern. She had no problems giving birth and was an excellent little mother, but her next litter of 3 adorable puppies put her at great risk. Before I found homes for them, their legs were almost the same length as their mother's height, and the vet said they must be the last for Willie's sake. That final birthing had not been an easy one, so I welcomed the vet's help and advice. Meanwhile, my eldest daughter, Claudia Ruth, and her future husband had brought home a beautiful dog offered to them as a Great Dane. She was young, very aristocratic in her bearing, and a lovely silver blue in color. We all admired her, and Willie seemed quite happy at the temporary companionship. But her presence brought a slow, sad end to our family of bantams. Zarka would, however, pave the way for a new permanent addition to the family. Her presence was of great interest to some friends in the neighborhood. Not long after her arrival, they heard of a couple of Harlequin Danes that had been left in kennels and had been abandoned by their owner. The kennel proprietor had said they could no longer afford to feed them and they would have to be put down. Our neighbors decided to go and have a look at the dogs, and my son, Jeremy, and younger daughter, Heather, accompanied them. The result was inevitable. They returned to the village with both dogs, the stronger of the two being kept by the neighbors and the other brought back to me, knowing I was unlikely to refuse to take in such a dejected-looking young animal. It was almost dark when they returned, and the preliminary discussion about the dog's future were still in progress when someone opened the front door and the dog fled out into the night. He must have been terrified after the long car journey and the sudden separation from his sibling. The search that followed was long and exhausting, and I think we nearly gave up, as it seemed a hopeless task in an area of rugged countryside, fields, dry stone walls, and the occasional farm. It was this farm that ended our growing despair, as the dog had taken refuge in the nearest open building, a shed where hay was stored. The farmer who supplied our daily milk found and shut him in before calling out that the dog was found. So we got him home again, safe on a lead, and settled down over a pot of tea to finish our former discussion on his future. This did not take long. He stayed, and we called him Sebastian. Sebastian was a pathetic picture, immature, very thin, and extremely nervous. His mainly black coat with small areas of white lacked any luster, and he showed nothing of the handsome dog he would become. He needed a lot of care, and after a visit to the nearest vet, my son and I were able to give him the daily injections that they had recommended. Regular meals, exercise, and love soon transformed him from a quivering wreck into a confident and handsome companion who was both gentle and affectionate. Sadly, his brother seemed to have inherited a vicious streak. I am not sure what happened to him, but we were indeed fortunate in being offered the second choice. For some months, we enjoyed a mixed pleasure of and problems of three dogs, two somewhat outsized and the other rather small. They got along with each other from the start, possibly because Willie seemed drawn to the larger members of her species, and Sebastian was originally too feeble to provide any threat or jealousy to either bitch. I think certain members of my family began, as the weeks went by, to dream of Zarka and Sebastian eventually having puppies, but this would never happen. Zarka was still at a destructive age while she was with us, and apart from chewing holes in a pair of trousers, managed to tear up a copy of Tolstoy's War and Peace one evening when she had been left shut in a bedroom. I do not recall that Sebastian ever destroyed anything, but he had to be watched during the preparation of meals. For dogs of his height, it was too great a temptation to walk past a table spread for dinner when plates were conveniently level with his nose. Cooked or uncooked, a chop can disappear in a second. After a few mishaps, we all learned as rapidly as the dog, but I never trusted Sebastian completely when the table was set for a meal. Another lesson we quickly learned with Sebastian was that it was far wiser to walk a long distance than travel by bus. Willie was used to bus travel. We needed to use three different buses to reach my childhood home, and when my dear uncle passed away, my mother and aunt lived there alone. Our local double-decker from the nearest town ended the journey just above our house, where it reversed and came back to halt at our front door. It then maneuvered slowly down a steep, winding lane before the terrain became easier. Dogs had to be taken to the top deck, and preferably to the back, an easy ascent for a long-legged animal, but hard for Willie. There was seldom any hurry as the driver took a short break, and I have seen the student members of my family on several occasions rise from their unfinished breakfast, mug in hand, to rush through the front door to board the bus. I always hoped the mugs would return in their bags at the end of the day. Willie usually rode on the seat so she could see through the window while Sebastian would have to stand on the floor. On this particular occasion, as the bus started moving, the floor slowly tilted and we moved out into the steep hill. We saw, to our horror, a little rivulet of liquid moving quietly down the center of the gangway. Sebastian, coming straight from the house with no time for other manners, had leaked. I can feel our embarrassment still. I have since experienced similar situations with a large dog on the car deck of a ferry, but violation of the relatively clean floor of our local bus was highly embarrassing. We watched almost mesmerized as the flow advanced and retreated with the level of the floor during the next half hour, praying no other passenger would mount the stairs, and when we got to our destination, alighting guiltily like a bunch of criminals, glad that the driver had left his seat. I think our guilt persisted whenever we used the bus for some time afterward, but it was never mentioned by the driver. Perhaps only the cleaner was ever aware of Sebastian's crime. The next time my daughter Heather, Willie, Sebastian, and I took the same journey, we left early in the day with a picnic lunch and an ordnance survey map. My mother was away and my aunt was alone, so we wanted to check that she was all right. It was a beautiful summer day, and one where we would have lingered dreamily by the stream while we ate our lunch if there had been more time. Willie played and explored while Sebastian, after a cursory view of our surroundings, lay down until we were ready to move again. The walk was a bit of a challenge, across country and partly new terrain, but we finally reached our destination, much to my aunt's pleasure. The time together passed too quickly, and leaving later than planned, I risked making the journey home by bus. Fortunately, the dogs were tired after their long and exciting day and slept soundly all the way home. Bus travel with them was undertaken only when absolutely necessary for some years until I was able to have a car of my own. Chapter 3, Dogs at School and in Other Places. Time for thinking about another move had arrived. I had finished my teacher training and probationary year. My eldest child, Claudia Ruth, was married. My son, Jeremy, busy shaping his own path through life elsewhere, and my youngest attending my old grammar school. The rugged upland weather conditions and very inadequate heating of our 18th century home was affecting my health, but unlike previous moves, it was not the prime motivation for my decision. Unexpectedly, we received a rather advantageous financial offer for the building, which I accepted. With no job or particular area in mind where I and my younger daughter, Heather, and the dogs could start life afresh, family discussions settled on a move to the Hampshire Dorset area, conveniently close at that time to where my eldest was living. I knew little about these counties, but the milder climate and proximity of the sea were attractive. I arranged to stay with Sebastian in the home of some of my elder daughter's friends while I found a job, a house, and a new school for Heather. She and Willie would stay with my mother and aunt and continue at secondary school until I had accomplished these tasks. Dogs are amazingly accommodating, adjusting easily to new situations, provided food and shelter and the close proximity of the person they have bonded with are assured. Sebastian and I were now sharing a very small room in a semi-detached house with a young couple and their two small children who were well under school age. We were made to feel very welcome, and the pittance I contributed was of help to the family budget. Nevertheless, however well-behaved Sebastian was, and he was very obedient, I could not leave him alone without my supervision. As a result, we spent much of each day away from the house. I think, looking back, it must have been a period of very dry weather as we explored further and further afield looking for houses for sale. One of my most urgent tasks also was to visit the local authority education offices where I had already given them my details, but there were no vacancies. It was getting toward the end of the school holidays, and I was told to call back after the start of the new term, not that I was given any hope of a job. At that stage, finding a home was my first priority, and I followed up every place within my price range, accompanied by Sebastian, at the same time getting to know the area and what it had to offer. He received a lot of attention and helped to smooth the way through problems that arose from time to time. The education office got very used to his presence as my visits gradually turned into daily ones, and the estate office staff were more likely to greet him first when we walked through the door. It was not long before I found what I wanted, but the process of buying would not be so simple. In 1970, it was very difficult for a woman to obtain a mortgage, however small, despite having been a sole owner of two previous properties. I had to get a letter from my family's bank manager over 200 miles away to guarantee the payment before the deal was settled. It was humiliating. My daily visits to the education office were at last successful, too. It was a case of being in the right place at the right time. A head teacher had fallen ill. Could I act as her deputy immediately? I could and did. Meanwhile, the house I found was empty, the owner having passed away many months previously, and legal issues were being finalized just when I came on the scene. I was able to move in as soon as the sale went through. Heather was accepted by a local grammar school, and Willie and Sebastian could be together again. We were delighted to be reunited. What the dogs thought of it all was fleeting, if they thought at all. They met as if they had only been apart for hours, not months. Willie's rear end wagged in pleasure, and Sebastian checked her out from nose to tail with satisfaction on seeing her. They inspected their new home in their own way as thoroughly as we did and gave the garden even more attention, tiddling and sniffing in every corner to establish the immediate past, present, and any future possibilities. Our new home was a typical 1930s semi-detached with two average-sized rooms downstairs, kitchen pantry, and spacious enclosed back porch. An exceptionally narrow hall and steep staircase led to three bedrooms and a bathroom. We had to adjust after all the space, albeit damp and shabby, that we had enjoyed in the north. When our possessions came out of store and were delivered, all went well until the final item was manipulated through the front door. It was a heavy, unwieldy 19th-century piano, and it got stuck. The more the removal men heaved, the more apparently permanently fixed it became, and it was a relief when they finally gave up, completely defeated. The dogs could only go in and out through the back door and the side entrance, and we could only go upstairs by crawling along the lid of the keyboard and the top. It took considerable time and ingenuity the following day for the obstruction to be resolved and the instrument safely placed in our new back room, much to our relief and that of the removal firm. Willie now became the self-appointed guardian of our small house. I imagine it was easier for her to guard than her previous home. Whenever anyone came to the front door, she got there first. Sebastian followed with his measuring stride. When the door was opened, Willie would often stand between his legs, barking quite ferociously, although she never moved over the doorstep, a relief as the paved entrance, designed for a parked car, had no gate. It would be some time before I passed a driving test and was able to park my old Morris Traveler close to the doorstep. Exercising the dogs at this time had to fit around the school routine. Sebastian and I knew the immediate area well from the house hunting and job searching days. From my initial temporary teaching post, I moved on to a permanent position in a progressive primary and middle school with a visionary head teacher. His energy and personality inspired loyalty from his staff, including volunteering some of our free time. My younger daughter was also occupied in adjusting to life at a new school where the ethos was very different to where she had been previously. As both of us were away from the house for long hours 5 days a week, I think Sebastian and Willie must have spent much time alone in the house and garden. There was a long straight path on both sides with a privet hedge dividing us from the next house and a weigela hedge between us and our next door semi. Willie often chased her large ball down the weigela path, and although the hedge was very attractive, particularly when covered with blossoms, poor Willie became the object of irate tirades from our elderly neighbor when her toy rolled against the sturdy shrubs. The ball did no harm, but we learned to avoid such games when the irascible old man was outside. There was a rockery with a few shrubs separating our garden and back porch. It made a useful barrier to our side entrance in the road so the dogs had a safe area to relax when it was sunny and do the things all dogs do in their daily enjoyment of life. A scenic viewpoint was only a short walk away from the house. It was a grassy area with wooded slopes overlooking the rapidly expanding sprawl of Pool in Dorset. The dogs could run free there, safe from traffic and apart from the occasional coach of visitors. During the summer, we met few people. The ones we did meet were always ready to talk. Dogs of Sebastian's size attracted immediate attention, even if it was just the much-repeated remark, "Why didn't you put a saddle on him?" Willie liked to explore, but Sebastian's exercise was more a sudden burst of speed and an equally quick return to stand at one side, apparently enjoying the view. There was one activity he soon discovered when we sat down on one public bench. He came rushing back after some exploratory excursion and, instead of slowing down, shocked us by clearing the bench in one great bound, narrowly missing our heads. After that, his pleasure in jumping whenever he reached the viewpoint became such a feature of the walk that my first thought when approaching was to check if anyone was sitting there before I unclipped his lead. I think he had just accomplished one of his leaps when a group of tourists drew up behind us, and within minutes, several delighted Chinese visitors were taking photographs of him. Fortunately, our walks and tourists did not coincide very often, but it was amusing at the time. One incident I did not find amusing was some of the exaggerated accounts I heard for a short time after we returned from a brief holiday. I had left the dogs in the care of Claudia Ruth and a teenage half-brother. She had brought Zarka with her, and the two Great Danes had been delighted to see each other again before we left. Our walks had sometimes coincided with two fashionably dressed ladies and their saluki's walking on the same road as ourselves, though on the opposite side of the road. The saluki's were always beautifully groomed and looked extremely elegant, aristocratic, and well-behaved. Their owners never acknowledged our presence, even when the road was empty of traffic. I felt, rightly or wrongly, that they rather despised our practical walking clothing and the excited corgi tugging on her lead. It seemed as if the distinctive size, coloring, and combination of our animals was not worth noticing compared with their own beautiful dogs, and the same sense of superiority extended to the people holding the leads, too. Unfortunately, during our absence, Zarka and Sebastian found the front door had not been properly closed and slipped out, Zarka following Sebastian on his customary route. Upon seeing the saluki's, what happened next was inevitable. They crossed the road and the saluki's took off, no doubt their alarmed owners dropping their leads. The four large dogs chased down the steep hill, which was very familiar to Sebastian from our once daily visits to the education office, and it was on the saluki's regular route to the nearest park. It is easy to imagine the havoc they caused, as the large area of parkland was a haven for both land and seabirds and was regularly grazed by numerous Canada geese. There were also some rarer birds such as black swans on the lake. People did not have mobile phones in the 1970s, so the dogs had a wonderful spell of freedom chasing each other, scattering the wildlife, and no doubt being far from silent before they were finally rounded up. I heard that the police had used nets in the end before they could be captured and restored to their homes, but we heard so much nonsense on our return that we probably never heard the full truth about the incident. My headmaster never ceased in his schemes to enhance the lives of his pupils. He called for the participation of his staff and the children's cooperation and actively encouraged any help that families could offer in fundraising or even building work. We had numerous jumble sales, fairs, and other outdoor activities and shared his delight in what we jointly achieved. My daughter Heather, who participated in many of these school activities, thought of how we might use Sebastian's popularity to raise money at these events. She ran a competition where people had to guess his length from the tip of his nose to the end of his tail. They paid to take part, and names and addresses and estimated lengths were carefully recorded. The winner was to be notified and rewarded in due course. Many people had a go, few getting anywhere near the actual figure. They had never seen him standing with his front paws on our shoulders, which might have given them some idea. but appreciated that he stood so patiently and was safe to be touched by their toddlers and preschool children. The whole idea was a great success, and the person with the nearest guess won a small prize without our revealing the actual figure, so we could use Sebastian as a fundraiser at future events. During my time as a member of this very happy and successful school community, the staff were aware that a new school had been planned and was being built in the area. Some of us went to view the building prior to completion. Its provisions still reflected now discredited tendencies to label and separate young children into different schools on the basis of being uneducable, subnormal, and maladjusted. The school was designed to bring together all these supposedly ESN or educationally subnormal children rather than teach them in mainstream schools. Upon completion, the local authorities invited teachers to volunteer for positions at the new school. I had a deep interest in children with special needs and many concerns about the labeling that often channeled children permanently away from mainstream classrooms and created great stigma. Although I was very happy where I was teaching, I decided to apply. I was accepted. A seemingly small move at the time, but one that would ultimately affect my future. Very early on, I realized that with a few exceptions, many of the children should have been retained in ordinary schools, just receiving extra support instead of such an emphasis on their differences. As my new head teacher followed the latter school of thought, only his desire to make a success of his new school and my own desire to do as much as possible for each child in my care made the position tolerable. I soon realized that the new school was based on a principle of separation and a vision of segregation that was far from my own beliefs. I also found that Sebastian and Willie would not be welcomed at my new school. Sebastian, however, was to play an important part in my work during the years that followed. We had many troubled children, and their poor attendance, despite the provision of transport, was of great concern. We were instructed to make home visits, and aware of some of the backgrounds, it was a daunting prospect without guidance and support. I had several children from the travelers' families who had been resettled by the local authorities and put into council houses much against their will. One of my frequent absentees was a delightful and intelligent boy whose father had a known violent history. The only way I could check comfortably on the missing pupil was to take Sebastian with me, his size offering me a sense of security as I ventured into the unfamiliar territory of home visits. Strangers did not know how gentle he was, and Sebastian had always placed himself in front of me when confronted with anything unusual. That's all the time we have to read on today's broadcast. We are reading My 90 Years with Dogs by Dorothy M. Norris. Remember, you can hear this and other audio reader programs on the web at reader.ku.edu/digital-archive. My name is Pam Bloom. Thank you for joining me.